Today I'd like to talk about something that we'd all like to have, and that's happiness. This is one of the things that the Buddha said all beings are seeking. And sometimes we think that Buddhism, because its central teaching is around the Four Noble Truths, the first of which is that suffering is an inherent part of this life, that Buddhism is a lot about suffering, not happiness. But in fact, the Buddha was pointing out to us what causes our unhappiness so we can create happiness for ourselves and others. And so the Buddha's teaching is basically about how to be happy. Tonight I'd like to particularly talk about the correlations between the Buddhist approach to happiness and some of the research findings that are coming out of modern psychology and sociology, to talk about the resonance between the way that the Buddha teaches us to create the conditions for happiness in our life and the discoveries that have been made through examining the way the mind works, actually the way the brain works, but also examining the conditions that have been shown to produce happiness in people when they've been investigated using research methods. Western psychology, only in fairly recent times, has started to pay a lot more attention to what makes people happy rather than what makes people miserable. A lot of past research and energy in psychology has gone into exploring the negative states of mind, like depression and anxiety, trying to understand where they come from and what produces them, because they bring so much misery to people's lives. And so a lot of energy has gone into trying to understand and cure those states of mind. And it's interesting, as these research methods have been developed and over time we've been investigating the changes that are taking place in modern society, as we become more affluent, we have more material prosperity, there's less hardship in most people's lives. What the statistics have revealed is that while the state of people's standard of living has increased dramatically since the Second World War, so have the levels of people reporting that they're depressed. And that is that people's happiness, or the overall levels of happiness that are being reported, don't seem to match the improvement in people's living standards. And so psychology is now taking a different tack. It's trying to understand what actually produces happiness. When we thought that it came from having comfort and being prosperous, that was where a lot of effort in society went to. But the results don't seem to show that that's really what's crucial. Certainly there's a standard of living that everyone needs to have in order to be relatively at ease with life. There is a standard of security in terms of having a place to live, having food on the table, having clothes to wear, having medicine when you're sick. And even in the monastic life, these are the four requisites the Buddha recognized that if you're going to develop the spiritual path, you do need material support. And these are the four things that everyone needs: food, shelter, medicine and clothing. And there is a certain level that one needs to reach in society where those things are available without constant struggle and worry, in order for people to feel somewhat at ease, somewhat happy. But beyond those basics, what the research has found is that people's levels of material prosperity are no sure guide to their levels of happiness. And the research has been pointing out some very interesting aspects of what creates happiness in people's minds. And these correlate very strongly with the approach of the Buddha. Basically, the psychologists have identified three different aspects of happiness. And first of all, I suppose we should define what happiness is. And basically, this is a positive emotional state, a state of mind that we would like to keep, not one that we want to get rid of. So we like to, how we know we're happy is it's we like to be like that and we'd like to stay like that. Within that definition of happiness, there are many different ways of elaborating on it. So a feeling of well-being, a feeling of satisfaction with one's life, feeling that one's life is worthwhile, feeling that one is satisfied with one's situation. These are all different ways of describing happiness. But the three aspects of happiness, which the psychologists have identified, go far beyond the kind of satisfaction with food, shelter, medicine and clothing than that is the basic necessity for life. The first of these aspects is to do with being able to produce pleasant experiences in one's life. That is, to have enough of the nice things, enough of the things that we would say in Buddhism are pleasures through the senses. So nice food, or at least enough food. These are all relative terms. Nice fragrances, nice sounds, nice sights, comfortable feelings with the body, and also thoughts which give rise to happiness. So the first aspect of happiness, we recognise, has to do with levels of comfort and the ability to produce as many pleasant experiences as possible in one's life. Now, if we look around at Australian society, we see even in Australian society, where people are relatively well off overall, that there's still a range of in the abilities of people to produce pleasant experiences. If you think about someone who's on $30,000 compared to someone who's on $100,000, you could say that there's a difference in what they can buy, how often they can enjoy the things that they like. There certainly will be differences in the amount of pleasure that they can give themselves. But that alone won't mean that the person who's got more money and can buy more things is going to be happier. What the psychologists have recognised is that there's a quirky aspect in the human mind, which instead of judging what we have and whether that's enough for what we need, and this is enough for having comfort and pleasure, there's something that they've called reference anxiety. And reference anxiety means that we don't judge how happy we are with what we've got by what we've got and whether that's enough to meet our needs. We judge it by whether what we've got is as much as what the person next door's got, or whoever else it might be that we're judging ourselves against. It might be the person at work, might be the person at school, might be the person that we went to school with. We judge ourselves and decide on whether we're satisfied with what we've got in relation to what other people have. And even if we've got more than we need, if we haven't got as much as those other people, or as much as we think we should have, that we're entitled to, then we won't be happy with what we've got. So this comparing ourselves with others, it's the old keeping up with the Joneses. But this again is only one aspect of this reference anxiety. The other thing that they've realised through doing lots of studies is that we also compare what we've got now with what we had in the past. We refer to the past. And if we've got now what we already had in the past, then it's not as good, it's not as pleasurable, it doesn't feel as satisfying if it's not a step up from what we used to have in the past. So, for example, if we didn't have a house, say we lived in a one-bedroom flat with many other people, and one day we were able to acquire a two-bedroom cottage with an indoor bathroom that only our family used, then we would think that two-bedroom cottage with the indoor bathroom that only our family used was just wonderful. It's great. How satisfied we'd feel. But if we grew up in a cottage with two bedrooms and a bathroom that only our family used, then it's not as exciting. It's not as satisfying. And what we're going to be doing is looking for the four-bedroom house with the two bathrooms that only our family can use. This is how the mind works, so it looks back to the past, and that affects our level of satisfaction with what we've got right now, how much we can appreciate what we've got right now. The other quirky thing that the mind does is it not only compares with other people, it not only compares with what we've had, but it also compares with what we're going to get in the future to decide whether what we've got now is really satisfying. And of course, this isn't, when I'm talking about deciding, this isn't intellectually comparing notes and recognising what's going on. This is all happening at a very unconscious level, this seeking the elusive happiness, the elusive satisfaction through the things that we can enjoy. And in looking to the future, what the psychologists have recognised is that if people think this is as good as it's going to get, there's no prospect for improvement, there's no way that four-bedroom house is going to get a jacuzzi or a sauna or whatever it is we think we need to finish it off, then again we're not going to be as delighted with it. The prospect of further improvement, the idea that we're going to be able to add on or go up or get more, that also adds to our happiness and our satisfaction. So this reference anxiety, which means moving off from what we have right now into the past, into the future, and comparing with what other people have, this all contributes, these are all factors in whether or not we're satisfied with what we've got right now. Now this is very significant for our practice, because one of the things that you will have noticed in the meditation, although we're trying to stay in the present moment and stay with the body as it is, even notice the body as it is, it's very difficult to do that because we run off into the past and into the future. It's only when we can allow the mind to settle and be still in the present moment that that inner peace arises. And when the inner peace arises, it's nice to be in the present moment. But when the mind is agitated or busy, when it's sleepy and can't stay with the present moment, then it doesn't feel so pleasant. And it feels like there's nothing here that's good enough to keep us focused in the present moment. The mind seeks something better, the missing thing that's not here right now. And this lack of contentment feeds off itself. So while ever the mind keeps roaming, it can never settle and the peace can never arise. In the meditation practice, one of the very basic skills that we learn is to focus in the present moment, to let go of the past and the future, and to focus continuously long enough and often enough so that that inner peace has a chance to arise. In order to do that, we have to be content with the present moment. We have to know that this moment is enough, this breath is enough, this body is enough, this is enough to stay paying attention. And when we pay attention long enough, we're content, that contentment grows. When that contentment grows, it allows the mind to settle and the peacefulness arises. The Buddha encourages us to investigate this again and again to see if this is true, to be able to stay focused, to be content in the present moment, to let go of the past and the future. Does it truly bring contentment and peace? This practice mirrors what we do in ordinary life, that we are constantly moving away from what we have, constantly looking for what's missing, what we don't have, what we're going to get next, and assuming that that thing will bring us the happiness that we're seeking. But when we get that thing, we don't get the happiness, not for long, because the mind very quickly gets fed up, has enough, isn't interested, isn't delighted, isn't as delighted, seeks something else, seeks something more. So one of the practices that we take into our daily life is not only to try to stay focused on where we are and what we're doing while we're doing it, but to to try to develop contentment with what we have. Focusing on what we have rather than what we don't have. And one of the ways that we develop this kind of contentment in the present moment with what we have in our life, focusing on the positive rather than looking at the negative, is called gratitude. Developing gratitude is one of the most powerful positive states of mind that we can generate. The Buddha called gratitude one of the highest blessings in life if we have it in our mind. Gratitude and contentment go hand in hand. And interestingly enough, the modern psychologists in their studies have also found that people who can develop a gratitude practice, the active cultivation of gratitude in their life, score much higher on levels of well-being than those who don't. And not only do they have a greater sense of well-being and they look on their life as a gift, so they take better care of themselves because they treat life as something that's precious, but it's also been shown that people who actively cultivate gratitude for what they have higher levels of energy. They're able to cope with chronic pain better than people who don't develop this kind of practice, and that it helps them to deal with all sorts of chronic illnesses such as high blood pressure and diabetes, because it improves their approach to the things that they have in their life, which are unpleasant, because they have a far greater appreciation of the good things that they also have in their life. And in studies that have been done with people who have chronic illnesses, where they've been given a gratitude practice to develop over a period of time, the changes in their levels of pain and levels of tiredness have been quite dramatic. And the gratitude practice that they've been given are simple things which we also talk about as part of Buddhist practice. One of the things is to, at the end of every day, look back over the day and recollect vividly three things that we've experienced in the day that we can be grateful for. So we might be grateful for the fact that we got all green lights on the way to work. Or we might be grateful for the fact that the weather was the way we were wanting it today for whatever it was that we were going to do. Or we might be grateful for the fact that our body's working today. And maybe if parts of our body aren't working that well, that we focus on those parts that are working and appreciate those. Another way of developing this gratitude practice is to look back not just at the day we've had, but over our life, and start deliberately bringing to mind those people in our life who've helped us, those events in our life that have been helpful and supportive, and to deliberately bring them to mind and go through them, remember them. And even better than just bringing those people to mind, having an even more powerful lasting effect in creating a sense of well-being in people, is to go and tell that person who's helped you that they have helped you. So taking the trouble to write a letter, taking the trouble to make a phone call, taking the trouble to go and see that person. And if we understand the way the mind works, the way the Buddha explained it, we can understand why doing that would have even a more powerful effect, because it takes many more mind moments a lot of more effort and energy to actually write that letter, to go and see that person. And so as much effort and time as we put into doing that, that much more we'll get out of it. And so cultivating gratitude is one of the most powerful practices for helping us to be happy and to helping us to be content with what we have. One of the precepts that we keep, particularly the precepts to do with not taking what is not given and not engaging in sexual misconduct, both those precepts very much centre around encouraging us to be content with what we have rather than looking at what we don't have and what we would like, even if it belongs to someone else. So this contentment is also a very powerful, positive state of mind, which the Buddha again mentions as one of the very highest blessings in life. When we practice meditation and we want to go further in meditation, we have to strengthen the contentment that we feel in the moment. If we're going to stay with the meditation object and move beyond the thinking mind, move beyond the scrambled mind to find the peace that comes when we can stay focused moment after moment after moment with the meditation object and relaxing into the moment as it is, being content. This lack of contentment is what prevents us from going further in the meditation practice. So not only is it essential for life, but it's essential for our meditation practice. And if we can cultivate it in daily life, it will help us to allow the mind to go to stillness in the meditation itself. Now, this ability to create pleasure, to have pleasant experiences, is only one aspect of happiness. Only one aspect of what makes people say that they feel satisfied with their life. The second aspect, which the psychologists have identified as being essential or a very powerful factor in contributing to people's sense of well-being, is what they've called the level of engagement that people have with their life. That is, how much actual involvement, how much time and energy we put into those areas of our life that we say are really important to us. So if I was to ask any of you, well, what's really important to you in your life? You might say, well, my family's really important to me, or my job's really important to me, or my health is really important to me, or the community's really important to me, or my spiritual practices are really important to me. And then I would ask you, well, how much time and energy do you give to your family, to developing the relationships and sustaining the relationships within your family? How much time and energy, how much real time and energy do you give to developing your spiritual practices? How much time and energy do you give to your job? And we're not saying which one of those things you should give more time to, which should be the focus. This is what people say is important to them in their life. And so the measurement is how much time and energy do you give to the things that you say mean a lot to you. And what the psychologists have recognised through their investigations is that when we say that something's really important to us and we don't actually spend much time or energy on it, then our level of engagement is minimal and very shallow. And that shallow engagement means less happiness. Greater happiness, greater satisfaction comes when we really put our heart into the things that we say are important to us. And no one's saying what those things should be, but if we want to get real satisfaction out of those things, then we have to give time and energy, make a commitment to it. We might say that we're really committed to Buddhist practice. So first of all, we ask then, what do you do in your practice? How much of it do you do? How often? How regularly? What sort of priority do you give to it? We might say that the Buddhist community is important to me, not just where I live, not the physical community, but the people who come together and practice, who uphold the kind of lifestyle that I want to lead. And then we might say, well, what do you do to support the Buddhist community? What do you do to encourage that kind of lifestyle? What do you give of yourself to support that community? And this is how we start to gauge levels of engagement in our life. Remembering it's not what other people say is important to us, but what we ourselves define as important. If we're not getting as much satisfaction out of those things as we think we should or we want to, then maybe we need to ask ourselves, am I really giving enough of myself to that? The next aspect of happiness, which the psychologists have identified, is what they call the meaningfulness of one's life, whether one's life seems to have a purpose, whether it matters that we're here or not. And the way that they get people to reflect on that is whether they have the opportunity in their life to give themselves to something bigger than just their own personal selfish interests, giving themselves selflessly without expecting anything in return. Something that they consider to be worthwhile, something that they consider to be important in life, and being able to contribute their skills, talents, time, energy to something which isn't for their own personal well-being directly. So giving time and energy to something like the Buddhist Society, looking after the centre, doing something that allows this place to continue. The level of meaningfulness in our lives is measured not by what we're going to get out of it personally, but how connected we feel to that thing that we're supporting. Now, recently we had a very good example of these kinds of levels of engagement and this meaningfulness when we think about the volunteer bushfire fighters fighting the fires around Perth. And we see it again and again and again. They give their time and energy. They often lose pay. They take time off work. They put themselves at risk. They actually put their life on the line for people that they don't even know. They don't know who lives in this house, but they're willing to go and risk their lives to save it. And if you ask them how they feel, they'd say after they've done that work, well, I feel great. I'm exhausted. I might even be sick as a result of it, but I feel great because I'm doing something that's really worthwhile. And in those moments of doing that, there's tremendous satisfaction. And not only the firefighters, many people go as volunteers to make sure that they have food around the clock when they're fighting. It's not 9 to 5. They have to keep fighting while ever the fire's there. There are people there to look after them when they get affected by the fire. All of those people doing things selflessly, not expecting anything personally in return, but having a high degree of involvement in the community that they say matters to them. Now, recently we had in the Buddhist Society a weekend of fundraising for the people affected by the tsunamis. And that was another very good example of people being engaged in something, giving their time and energy, not expecting anything back personally. And people spent many hours preparing the food and the things that were offered for sale. And it's very comical if you think about what you would say to someone if you were describing what they were going to be asked to do on that weekend. If you said to someone, "How about you go and stand in your kitchen for 7 hours tomorrow, right through until late at night, don't get to bed till late, it's going to be pretty hot, but stay in that kitchen for 7 hours and cook all the food that you can, then bring it down to the Buddha Center and stand in the sun for another 8 hours, it's going to be hot, very hot, and you're going to sell all this food and whatever else you've produced. Stay there all day. You can't go home just because you're tired and hot. Wait till it's all gone. And you're not going to get any money out of it just because you provided it, cooked it, and stood there and sold it. Don't think you're going to get anything out of it. The money's all going to someone else. Now, if you ask someone, "Hey, how about coming and having a great time doing all that?" People would say, "What? Crazy. I've got better things to do with my day, my night." Some people days before doing the work that was necessary. But if you ask the people who participated on that weekend, whatever they were doing, they might have been helping put up the tents, they might have been helping clean up the mess, they might have been attracting people's attention to come and buy what was here. All of those people would have said, "I feel great. It was worth it. It was something that I'd gladly do again if the opportunity arises." And yet it doesn't make sense in a worldly sense. But these people have a very high level of engagement, not only in the Buddhist society, but in the Buddhist community. And not only in the Buddhist community, in the human community. The money that they were raising wasn't going to even places that they have any connection with. No one they know, and yet they were glad to do it. And to do that kind of work and to put yourself out like that makes life feel worthwhile. It matters that we do these things. It matters not because we're getting something out of it personally, but because it contributes to the greater good. And the studies have shown that when people have these three aspects in their life, the pleasure of nice things, or at least comfort, need being fulfilled, when they have this feeling of being engaged in their life at a very deep level, and a feeling that their life has meaning because of what they can contribute to the greater good, then these people report the highest levels of personal satisfaction and fulfillment with their life. They're the people who are truly happy. Now, it doesn't mean that they're happy every minute of the day, every day of the year, every year of their life. Even the happiest people have their downs, and we know that. And even if we're practicing very well and we can keep our minds fairly balanced, there will be still things which upset us, still things which make us sad. when we hear that a good friend is sick, or we know that someone that we know has died, we're going to be feeling touched by that, saddened by that. But we'll be much more resilient to be able to deal with those difficulties in our life, because our mind will have the strength that comes from inner happiness, the strength that comes from that inner feeling of satisfaction with our life. To live in this way, where we are connected with others, where we're willing to step outside our comfort zone, to share ourselves with others, these are all fundamental aspects of the Buddhist path of practice. In the Noble Eightfold Path, the Buddha mentions right speech, right action, right livelihood, even down to the way we earn our living is part of the path of practice. And the way that we earn our living in a harmless way, the way we earn our living in a way which supports life, this is part of this engagement and connection with the whole of life. Every aspect of the path encourages us to see ourselves not as an individual isolated, living in our own cocoon, but as connected with every other being, connected with every other human being particularly. And whatever good fortune we have, whatever good fortune we're able to develop through our hard work, through our talents, through our skills, to make sure that we don't keep that just for ourselves, that we share it around, whether it's sharing our material prosperity or sharing the skills and talents that we have, or just sharing our kindness with others. So what the modern psychologists have been able to recognise, to define as aspects of happiness, as the conditions that produce happiness in people's lives, mirror very much the conditions and the practices that the Buddha advocated all of us to undertake, not only for the well-being of others, but because it produces true inner happiness, true well-being for ourselves. Next time you feel drawn to go out and get something with the expectation that that's going to give you the happiness that's eluded you up until now, stop and take a look. First of all, question that drive, that craving to reach out for what's not in this moment right now. And before you go and follow that impulse, take a look at what you've got already in your life. Develop that feeling of gratitude. Sometimes we can make a pact with ourselves: until I reflect on this and can reflect with gratitude, see what I've got, I won't act. Take time to really consider whether what you're about to run after is really going to bring into your life anything that you don't already have. When we can be content with what we have, when we don't want anything else, then that is true wealth. That is true prosperity. That is true happiness. To reach that point, we have to be willing to keep on investigating and questioning our assumptions and relating what we experience in our life to the teachings that we've heard. So may the teaching that you've heard this evening help you to investigate your own life, and may it help all of you to bring the conditions of happiness into your life, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be happy to hear them. So yes, so the question or the reflection is around if contentment and gratitude lead to happiness, what about the other, the opposite, and that is the feeling that I'm owed, that that I should be getting something more. Is that? Yes. So then we investigate that. When we are reflecting on these things and the teachings that we've heard, it's one thing for me to say this is what the teaching says or this is what the experts have discovered. It's another thing for you yourself to do your own investigation and see what you discover in your own experience. So next time you have the sense of I should get this or I'm owed this or it's not fair if I don't have this, you investigate, you stop, and you apply your mindfulness to investigate what it feels like to be in that state. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? What gives rise to that state? Where does that come from? What's happening? Is that pleasant or unpleasant? Is it peaceful or not peaceful? This is how we investigate. So it's not a matter of someone telling us I'm owed brings misery. It's a matter of us finding that out for ourselves. And when we start to investigate where that comes from, we might see the conditioning in our life that's led to that. We might be able to recognise the wrong view, the wrong understanding that we've picked up somewhere or we've been taught by someone or that we heard and we thought we'd try it out. This is how we investigate to find out for ourselves whether it's true. So that was it, is what I would encourage you to do with any of those opposites. And then also when gratitude is present, when contentment is present, does it feel good? Is it pleasant? When I say I'm happy, what's going on? What's actually going on? What produces that happiness? Not what someone else told me. Just because sister said that there are these three aspects to happiness, don't have to believe it. Now go out and investigate it for yourself. Ah, it's not true. Okay, don't believe it if it's not true. If it is true, then develop it. Maybe true in some respects. Maybe true, not true. That's what you have to find out. So the feeling of I'm owed comes with the sense of what I've got isn't enough. So that feeling of lacking, we start looking at that, we start noticing that. What's lacking? When is it lacking? What will take that away? What works and what doesn't? This is how we use these kinds of questions about life and our practice to find out for ourselves. Yes? When you're having gratitude, can you have gratitude for the unwholesome things in your life as well? Is that what you're saying? Well, depends what those unwholesome things are. Unwholesome by definition means that it's harmful to us. That's the Buddha's definition of what's unwholesome. It means that it harms us or harms someone else. So it's very hard to have gratitude for something that does that, that harms us or harms someone else. If we do have gratitude for that, then maybe we'd have to take a look at what we mean by gratitude and what that thing is really bringing into our life. So if the unwholesome thing is like going and having a second piece of cake when you know that one is really enough, then and being, you know, thinking, oh, that second piece of cake was just delicious, I'm really grateful for that, that's possibly something that could be used. But anything that harms, which is the definition of unwholesome, is something that we need to take another look at. So the question is that if you're developing contentment, developing gratitude all the time, isn't that the opposite of contentment? And if you get all the green lights on the way to work one day, aren't you going to be upset when you get the red ones the next day? But in fact, you have to generate these states of mind, because what we're doing is we're changing our perceptions. The mind very easily only picks out the negatives in our life. It picks out the negatives and refuses to see the positives, and that's how we get into very depressed states of mind, or feelings of not having enough, not having what we need, because we don't see all the things that we've already got. So with the development of gratitude and giving rise to contentment, gratitude is such a positive state of mind, has such a powerful influence on the mind, that it energizes the mind and makes it much better able to remain stable and resilient and buoyant when difficulties come. So when we get the red lights the next day, we're not so worried about that, because the mind has been made more buoyant and more resilient through the gratitude practice that we've done. It's a counterbalancing of the negativities that usually arise, so that eventually the way of looking at things is that we do pick out the positives rather than the negatives. So even red lights can become something that we're grateful for. Gee, I'm so pleased that I've got these few minutes to sit at the light and just watch my breath. I'm so pleased that I've got a few minutes to sit at the lights and just relax my body. I'm so pleased I've got these few minutes to sit at the light and watch everyone drive by so nicely. Believe it or not, it becomes possible to find something without just being artificial. Things just change, our perceptions change the more that we cultivate these positive states of mind. And as contentment arises, it doesn't mean that we don't act on what we need to do, but the mind is much better able to deal with what needs to be dealt with, because it hasn't lost its energy through being miserable or irritable. Now, when we're driving to work and we get annoyed with every light, we create so much tension in the mind and the body that we're actually losing the energy that we need to deal with driving in the traffic. And by the time we get to work, we're exhausted. So we're conserving energy through cultivating these positive states of mind, and that energy can then be applied to dealing with whatever we have to deal with much more skillfully. Well, I think, oh, sorry, one more question. That's true. Yeah. So the thing is being grateful for what we don't have, the things we don't have to worry about. So if you don't have a car, you don't have to worry about someone stealing it. And this is one of the things when we're simplifying our life, and this is one of the things that usually comes naturally once we've been practicing for a while, that we see that many of the things we have that we think are assets are actually burdens. And life is much more pleasant without having to worry about all of those things, because everything we've got needs to be maintained. Everything we've got needs to be looked after. Everything we've got needs to be replaced and when it runs out. And if we've become dependent on it, then we get all upset when it's running out. But if we're used to not having it, it's one less thing to get upset about. So being grateful for what we don't have is an aspect of gratitude practice. So one of the things we can be grateful for is my back's not aching today. That's a very good thing to, you know, if we've got a back that aches a lot of the time, the days that it doesn't ache, we notice that. We're grateful that the back's not aching today. So I think that's probably enough.